Mona, when people think of human rights, I think they think of dictators, of wars, of human suffering. And when they think of science and technology, they think of laboratories, computers, maybe nerds. And to the extent that there's any overlap at all, I can imagine people thinking maybe only about negative things like the wiring of prisoners at Abu Ghraib or the science of torture. You head the Science and Human Rights Program at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. What are the positive connections between science and human rights that your group is trying to foster?
Well, there are many, actually. Scientists have a history of being very concerned about freedoms of all kinds, freedom to practice science, freedom of expression, freedom of scientific inquiry. And they've also had a history of being very actively involved in defending the human rights of individual scientists who have been oppressed or under threat around the world. So there's a kind of natural affinity between scientists and human rights. But what's interesting is that increasingly we're finding that they're open to considering additional ways in which they can be engaged in human rights. And that's what the Science and Human Rights Program at AAAS is about, is exploring those openings, that interest that we're picking up in figuring out what else can they do. That is the question. As scientists, what else can we do? And at AAAS, we're discovering a number of different things.
So there's specific scientific technologies, I guess, or techniques that could be brought to bear. I think many people are aware of the fact that in situations where there's been genocide and mass graves, conventional forensic medicine can come to bear to identify bodies and how they were killed. Does it go beyond that? Do we get into fancier science, genetics, or other applications?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That and much more, definitely. It began, in fact, AAAS, the Science and Human Rights Program, pioneered in the 1980s the application of forensic and genetic sciences to the, at that time, exhumation of mass graves in Argentina. Hmm. That was in the 1980s. In the 1990s, the program developed large-scale violations of human rights via statistical information management techniques. That was the first time that had been done, and the program staffer at the time actually gave evidence at the International Tribunal on the former Yugoslavia in the case against Milosevic.
So this was a matter of using computer technology, of having to develop new computer technology just to organize all the information from these bodies?
It wasn't so much the technology, but it was organizing the information, how to collect and organize and capture the patterns and predictions of activity. That was, I think, what was really unique.
Because patterns of abuse are crucial to a conviction of genocide.
Yes, absolutely. Because it's hard to capture intent in the sense of knowing you're not going to get the papers and documents necessarily that easily giving the orders. So if you are able to identify the patterns and compare the evidence and the data, then it's possible, it seems, in that case.
You know, it's great to see science in the service of bringing perpetrators to justice. It would be great if we could get further upstream. Are there ways in which science can be brought to bear with the idea of preventing human rights abuses?
Oh, we certainly hope so. In fact, what we do say is imagine what scientists have been able to accomplish with better documenting and reporting of violations. For example, most recently, the Science and Human Rights Program has been engaged in developing geospatial technologies applications for human rights. We've done work in Darfur and Burma and Zimbabwe. But at the program is a geographer who brought this technology and this tool to human rights. So imagine if all disciplines considered what they might be able to contribute, how their tools and expertise might be brought to bear to human rights challenges. Who knows what might be possible in terms of prevention and early warning.
So when you talk about geospatial and a geographer, we're talking about satellite images here?
Yes, that's correct. And there are other technologies, but principally we're using satellite imagery.
So how could a satellite imagery perhaps give an early warning of a problem as opposed to identifying something afterwards, like seeing evidence mm-hmm. of mass graves?
The program last year worked with Amnesty International USA on Darfur and produced the Eyes on Darfur website, which is really remarkable. I encourage everyone to visit this Amnesty International website. We worked with them to set this up. It's basically tracking the situation through images of 12 villages in Darfur. And the idea is that we have eyes in the sky, and it is sent as a signal to the potential perpetrators of further human rights violations that these 12 villages we are watching, we are keeping an eye on what is happening there. And so far, thank goodness, they've been fine. Who knows what the relationship is? We would like to hope that it was helpful in prevention.
So this is really a case of the whole world is watching literally on the web.
Beautifully put. Hmm.
It seems to me, Mona, that it wouldn't necessarily be that scientists would bump into at their usual dinner parties human rights activists and find out that they have something to share with each other. How can we help people in need find people with the skills that could help out in human rights cases?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You're so right. There's scientists have so much to contribute to human rights groups, and human rights groups have such a need for science and scientific expertise. And the problem is, how do they meet? How can they meet? How can they find each other? And to address that, we recently launched a new project we're calling On-Call Scientists. It's a project aimed at cultivating the tradition of pro bono science and pro bono scientists. Just as there are pro bono lawyers and pro bono lawyering for human rights groups, we're determined to set up the same thing, establish the same tradition of pro bono science and scientific expertise for human rights organizations. And this is it's an online system where scientists can go to volunteer, to be available, to provide their time and expertise and answer questions in the service of human rights organizations or UN field offices that are engaged in human rights work or in national human rights institutions. Similarly, parallel to that, we have a database that receives requests from these organizations for scientific expertise. Mm-hmm. And as these fill up, then we have a committee that will be working on seeing what are the optimal partnerships between them. We're very excited because we just launched this in October, and we already have over 90 scientists who have signed up to volunteer.
Wow, so, this is the ultimate online matching dating
service. Precisely, precisely. What could be better?
How did you get into the business of science and human rights? Are you a scientist by training? Are you a human rights advocate? Have you somehow, how do you become both?
Well, by training, I'm a sociologist, and I feel that probably my turning to sociology had something to do with human rights in the sense that sociologists want to figure out how to fix things, and what's better to fix than the situation of the human condition. My first encounter with human rights was in the 70s in working on actually the Palestine Human Rights Campaign. From then on, my passion for human rights grew, and I was very fortunate to find an opportunity where I could combine my scientific training as a sociologist with my passion for human rights.
So I can see how the science of sociology might blend reasonably well with the human rights issues. I could imagine that for some of the more technical sciences, people who are normally in a lab and not really, you think of scientists as not being very good at dealing with other human beings sometimes. Have you found some cultural gaps that you've had to bridge? How do scientists generally get along as they try to get into the human rights business?
Well, there are issues on both sides, I have to say. One of the things we are working on is looking at the language, developing translation documents and what scientists need to know about human rights and what human rights practitioners need to know about scientists and working together. So there are, of course, issues there, but they're not anything that can't be overcome. In fact, they're both sides, both communities are enriched by working with the other. I want to say about science is that in some cases, it's inconceivable, possibly inconceivable to imagine that they could contribute somehow to human rights. But then you discover that it is actually possible. Last year, we were contacted by a human rights group that's working to set up an international group working to set up a small human rights organization in southern Sudan, and they want to look at the contamination of water that's resulting. What they suspect is a result of the drilling for oil that is taking place there. Mm-hmm. So we worked to try to find a hydrologist to work with them. And here's a hydrologist. It was fascinating because as I was reaching out to find hydrologists through several communications with one who responded with curiosity at first, after several communications, he emailed back and said, "Well, you know what? I think water should be a human right." And I was delighted to respond with my response to him, include several URLs to places where he could go and discover that indeed water is a human right.
A newly radicalized hydrologist.
Exactly. And he will not look at human rights in the same way ever again.
I can imagine also that scientists, though, because they're so used to sticking to the evidence, wedded to the evidence, they sort of pride themselves sometime on not adding interpretation. I could imagine it would be difficult for some of them to make the leap into advocacy. Mm-hmm. It sounds like from the experience with this hydrologist, something sometimes clicks.
Yes, you're right. There are different comfort levels. There really are, and we have to be patient. We understand that. At AAAS, I should say, the Science and Human Rights Program projects that apply science and technology to human rights, we do not, those projects are not involved in advocacy directly. We are focused very much on the science piece. But we realize that with human rights work, it's not going to happen on its own. You can't just do the science piece and expect it on its own to translate into human rights advances. So all those projects are conducted in partnerships with human rights groups, with human rights organizations. They do the advocacy directly. But we are also creating other opportunities where scientists can become advocates for human rights. Since we are celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, there is an article, few people know this, but there is an article, Article 27, devoted to, as a human right, the enjoyment of the advancement of science and scientific progress. So that is something scientists will very naturally want to advocate for, I'm sure, and do now indirectly. But once they know that it's actually a human right, we hope they become human rights advocates.
I think that's so interesting. I think there are very few scientists out there who know that the work they are doing is actually embodied described as a human right in a Universal Declaration.
You're absolutely right.
60 years ago. Let's just talk for a minute about how to put some of these things into action in terms of public policy. I imagine that at least at this point in our nation's history, the U.S. government is not seen around the world as the savior of human rights. There's been a lot of discussion about that in the course of the last administration. Is there, though, a role for federal government as we have a new administration coming in, something to look ahead to?
Well, we certainly hope so. And as human rights advocates, our role is to make sure that the governments, including, or I should say especially our own, given that we are in we are U.S. citizens, meet their human rights obligations. They have obligations. Our government has obligations to respect, protect, and fulfill the various human rights. That is their role. That is what they ought to be doing. So really, I guess it's not a question of is there a role for them to play, or it is their responsibility. So in that sense, there is a role for them to play. Mm.
Well, as you mentioned, this year and, in fact, this week is the 60th anniversary of the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. No better time than to reaffirm our commitment to those rights as a nation. Just as a final point, you've got an interesting conference coming up on this, don't you? Tell us
yes,
about that.
Yes, we do. On January 14th through the 16th, we are launching the AAAS Science and Human Rights Coalition. This is a coalition or a network of scientific associations, professional societies, and science academies that believe that scientists and science are vital to the realization of human rights. We're coming together. We've been working, over 20 associations have been working collaboratively over the past year to lay the foundations for this coalition, and we're looking forward to January launching it publicly. We're very honored to have as one of the speakers, Mary Robinson, the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and the former President of Ireland. Her joining us attests to the importance that the human rights community is placing on the engagement of as many segments as possible in the realization of human rights, and it's very clear that they are welcoming this initiative by scientists.
Great. Mona Yunus, thanks very much.
Thank you.